Thanks very much, Melinda, for that welcome and that introduction. It's my pleasure to be here this morning on this occasion, and the panel wants to thank the Institute and the Insurance Council for putting on this event. And in referring to the panel, let me introduce you to my colleagues. We've got Jim Minto, excuse me, down the front here. Could you stand up, Jim, just because not everybody knows Jim. Christine Barron sitting behind Jim is the head of the Secretariat based in Canberra. And John Beryl's here somewhere. Where are you, John? Thank you. So we're all here this morning to hear what's to come later. Our issues paper was released just over 4 weeks ago, and it put some models on the table for flood insurance, and it raised a number of other questions on other matters. This audience here today, you're a highly informed one, and we are keen to hear as wide a range of views as possible from you on the questions raised in the issues paper. Those views could be today, or they could be in submissions that are yet to come. Since commencing the review, we've met with a range of stakeholders and addressed a number of different forums. This week, for example, we've met some insurance executives this morning. We're meeting a group of water engineers later today. We're off to Brisbane, Cairns, Innisfail and Tully over the next couple of days, and we've got other meetings planned. We've also met with a number of interested people, including consumer representatives, social workers, building experts, local councils, credit unions and banks, as well as with insurers and actuaries. But before turning to the models and the questions in our issues paper, I want to reiterate why this review was commissioned by the government in the first place and what the review panel sees as the essential problems that we are dealing with. Following the events of this summer, on 13th of February 2011, the Council of Australian Governments, or COAG, adopted the National Strategy for Disaster Resilience. The strategy focuses on prevention, mitigation and resilience across the whole community. Importantly, COAG also agreed on the importance of insurance in disaster recovery. Insurance does play a key role in that recovery. It helps people deal with significant financial loss and provides help to rebuild, repair or replace damaged property. Insurance is also importantly about individuals taking responsibility for themselves, their families and their businesses, and so sharing the cost of recovery fairly with the community and governments. One of the principles that the government set for this review is therefore to encourage individuals and businesses to insure themselves where practical. And here are the government's objectives as stated in our terms of reference. Insurance takes on added importance following a natural disaster when whole communities have suffered loss and damage. Insurance plays a key part in the ability of the community to recover, not only to allow people to return to their homes, but to support businesses that provide employment and goods and services to the community and to community facilities that give life to the community. It was not the extreme weather events of the past summer themselves that stimulated this review, for the insurance industry has demonstrated in these events and others that it has the financial capacity and other resources needed to respond effectively to such events. But it was the absence of flood insurance for many policyholders, particularly in Brisbane and Ipswich, that was the primary stimulus for the review. The fact that all home insurance policies cover storm damage, but many do not cover flood, allied with the insurance industry's distinction between the two, which is seen as an arcane and confusing distinction by many, has led to a community backlash against insurers, to their distress, of course, and considerable distress, financial loss and disillusionment for many insured homeowners. Hence the guiding principles in our terms of reference as well, about availability and affordability, risk mitigation and encouragement to insure. The theme of the review arising from the flood problem and the full terms of reference is the availability and affordability of insurance offered by the private insurance market, with particular reference to flood and other natural disasters. This acknowledges, firstly, that there is currently a flood insurance problem, and secondly, that the insurance industry cannot be expected to solve the flood insurance problem entirely on its own. The evidence available to the review panel is that a very high proportion of houses, probably more than 95%, have household insurance. We understand that home insurance is readily available for almost all homes in Australia, and that the vast majority of owners are prepared to pay for that insurance at current market-determined prices. What is not clear is the proportion of households that have insurance that includes cover for flood. But we do know from the Brisbane and Ipswich floods that there were many homeowners with insurance that excluded cover for flood. And what was the outcome? Anger and confusion among homeowners about whether they had insurance cover for flood and whether it was made clear to them at the time they purchased their insurance policies. Also, some insurance claims that took many months to be resolved in order to determine whether the damage was caused by a form of flood that was not covered by the policy. Hydrology reports were required, sometimes more than one hydrology report, first on an area basis, then on a property-specific basis, and sometimes even another one. So there's been considerable delay and uncertainty for some of those who were flooded. It also delayed repair and rebuilding of homes, access to assistance from the Premier's Fund, and the ability of people to start to resume a normal life. That is to say, it hampered the ability of insurance to perform its role in recovery. The private insurance industry has responded very effectively and in line with community expectations in most recent natural disasters. For example, the Hunter storms in 2007, the Black Saturday bushfires in Victoria in 2009, the Perth and Melbourne hailstorms in last year, and more recently Cyclone Yasi, and substantially the storms in Toowoomba and the Lockyer Valley. But the reaction to the 2011 floods that affected Brisbane and Ipswich and the floods in northern Victoria was different. Community expectations were not met, and equally community needs were not met by the insurance coverage that was in place in Brisbane, Ipswich and northern Victoria. One simple indicator of this community need not being met is the number of disputes referred to the Financial Ombudsman Service relative to the total number of claims lodged with insurers. That number for the floods is more than 10 times the number for each of Cyclone Yasi, the Victorian bushfires and the hailstorms in Melbourne and Perth last year. 10 times. The difference, of course, is that in the bushfires, cyclones and storms, homeowners who had purchased home insurance were automatically covered for these events. There was no need for the homeowner to know how a bushfire or cyclone was defined. There was no need to make specific inquiries about whether the event was covered when purchasing the product over the phone or the internet. Let me make it clear that these outcomes following the floods are not regarded by me or the panel as criticism of the insurance industry's willingness and ability to mobilise resources and to deal effectively with disasters. Indeed, the performance of the insurance industry, for example, following the Victorian bushfires, is acknowledged as being of a very high standard and making a significant contribution to the ability of those communities to recover. I say that because we've had the explicit feedback, and I'm sure if I went and asked people for some of the other disasters, we'd get the same response. The industry's also demonstrated over the past summer that it was able to get resources to where they were needed to deal with a quick succession of significant natural disasters. And it really was an extraordinary period, wasn't it? The industry's also taken significant steps in the past few years to address the technical difficulties around flood cover and to offer products into the market. So the issue is not so much one of insurer performance, but that, in the interests of both homeowners and the community, many homes that should have flood cover included in their insurance policies do not have it. In the event of a serious flood, many of the resulting costs have had to be met by individuals, the community, charities and government. And why do we have the problem? Because historically, flood coverage has been either uninsurable or unaffordable to many. Hence the panel's emphasis on flood cover for homes. What can be done to meet the community need for home insurance policies to extend water events, including floods, in much the same way as they extend to bushfire, cyclones, earthquakes and storm? While acknowledging that the insurance industry has made efforts to deal with flood insurance and has made progress, especially in the last decade, and will clearly make further progress stimulated by recent events, and we've had strong confirmation of that by discussions with the industry. There's a lot being done now so that flood cover will be much more widely available soon. These efforts cannot be expected to fully meet the community need for widely available and affordable flood cover. This slide is in our issues paper. I don't need to explain it to this audience, but it just clarifies the problem. The existence of flood or natural disaster insurance schemes in many other countries, incidentally, is testimony to the limited ability of private sector insurance markets to fully meet the needs of the community in a satisfactory way. For homes exposed to flood risk, more insurers are now preparing to extend the availability of flood cover. And for homes exposed to a high level of flood risk, though, flood cover availability will always be problematic in a private insurance market. Insurers are likely to attempt to underwrite or price themselves out of this higher risk business, or else they'll just find that nobody wants to buy the product because of the price. Hence, a competitive market at the high risk end is unlikely to exist. The problem's also exacerbated by the uncertainties associated with assessing flood risk in high-risk areas. As a specific example, it might be difficult for insurers to determine realistic assumptions about the future flood mitigation outcomes of the Wivenhoe Dam, and hence a reasonable price for the cost of flood risk in the areas surrounding the Brisbane River. An insurer pricing such homes for flood risk is almost certainly going to engage in what I would describe as defensive pricing. The business will be marginal at best and probably unattractive from an underwriting viewpoint. So the insurer will tend to take, quite justifiably, a pessimistic view or a cautious view of the risk and therefore put a high price on the insurance. Well, much more could be said about the economic, social, and psychological importance of natural disaster insurance, but I think that what I've already said is a sufficient introduction to what we might call the flood insurance problem. I'd like now to talk a little bit about personal responsibility and risk mitigation. There are benefits to the community from supporting homeowners to protect themselves from loss through purchasing insurance. If they have insurance, they bear some of the costs through payment of a premium and perhaps an excess when a loss occurs. Having the homeowner bear some of the cost provides a signal about the level of flood risk the individual is facing. This provides an incentive to the homeowner to attempt to manage the risk, for example, by undertaking mitigation or considering relocation. Having insurance for natural disasters does not reduce the immediate distress for individuals or communities that can be caused by a natural disaster, but it can assist the speed and effectiveness with which the community can recover. By helping individuals to repair and rebuild their homes quickly after a natural disaster, insurance can help the community as a whole to recover and allow the social and community life to resume. The benefits of mitigation undertaken by a homeowner will also be shared across the broader community. Actions taken by the homeowner can have impacts on neighbours and on community facilities. It can also limit the non-financial costs of disasters, such as those to human life and social infrastructure. These non-financial social costs can be very high and they're uninsurable. So risk mitigation has a part to play in making flood cover more available and more affordable through the potential to reduce the severity of flood risk and the number of households exposed to flood risk. Risk mitigation, both through reducing flood risk faced for homes and improving the ability of homeowners to make informed decisions about where to live, is a crucial part of any strategy to improve the resilience of the community and its recovery after a natural disaster. Mitigation efforts have limitations, though, and can require substantial investment. While it may be achievable to ensure that no further development takes place in areas of moderate and high flood risk, and I'm not absolutely certain about that, some of the insurers are very concerned about the way councils or state governments even are willing to open up flood-prone land when there's, as we have at the moment, pressure for more housing. Nevertheless, that may be achievable to limit that type of development, but it'll be considerably harder to mitigate the risks for existing homes in these areas. So in considering all options to improve availability and affordability, the review panel is putting particular focus on avoiding moral hazard and providing a positive incentive to reduce flood risk over time through mitigation. Let me now talk about the models. The two models that the issues paper has described seek to address directly the issues of the availability and affordability of flood cover. Automatic flood cover would oblige all insurers offering household insurance to include flood cover and oblige all households to have flood cover. in the event of a flood, all those affected would be able to call on the resources of the insurer for financial support, as well as practical support in restoring their homes. It would also obviously eliminate the storm versus flood disputes and the associated delays and uncertainties that occur. Insurance would be able to respond as effectively in the aftermath of a flood as it has shown itself able to respond following a bushfire, storm or cyclone. Introduction of automatic flood cover would therefore eliminate two major failures that have occurred in the 2011 floods in relation to residential property insurance. One failure is the absence altogether of flood cover for some property owners, and the other is the inclusion of limited cover only or sublimits for flood cover, compared with full cover for other forms of water damage. Of course, with no other intervention, the premiums for some homes would rise. Some may rise to levels that the owners consider are more than the value of more than the value that they place on insurance, or for those on constrained incomes, more than they can budget for. There is therefore a real risk that such households would take out no household insurance, leaving them exposed to all risks, not just flood. For this reason, the paper proposes a pool for homes with high flood risk, in principle to act as an insurer of last resort, such that insurers could offer flood cover at affordable prices without being saddled with underwriting risks that they do not wish to undertake. The issues paper also puts forward another model for discussion that would allow homeowners to opt out of automatic flood cover. Under this model, all insurers would be obliged to offer flood cover, but households could choose to buy insurance that excluded flood cover but still retain insurance for other risks. An opt-out model like this would almost certainly ensure considerably greater take-up of flood cover than the status quo. Any opting out of flood cover would be intended to represent a clear and informed choice on the part of the homeowner. However, disputes over flood versus storm could still continue. All of these models, allowing the market to respond to recent events with more offerings of flood cover, called in the issues paper the status quo, automatic flood cover and automatic flood cover with opt-out, all of those will result in more flood cover. I think that's clear. They will therefore all result in more of those affected, potentially affected by floods, having insurance available to rebuild their homes and their lives. All should reduce the number of disputes, delays and uncertainties. But clearly there would be differences in the take-up of flood cover for each model. A key issue for the review panel, and one on which we look forward to receiving submissions, is the likely effectiveness of each of these models with a good explanation of why you think that they should be adopted or should not be adopted, and how they could be made to work if they were adopted. Let me talk a little bit now about flood mapping. Improving the availability of flood cover requires access to data to enable insurers to adequately price flood risk. Access to suitable flood mapping and other data to assess flood risk was therefore on the review's radar from the beginning. It is usually councils who arrange this information because they require it to avoid developments in areas with high flood risk and otherwise to manage water flows and flood risk. There is a variation in how effectively they do this, but it's something that all councils do to some extent. It's clear too that homeowners would get some benefit by being able to make informed choices over where to live if they had good access to flood risk information. So data on flood risks is important not only for insurance but for mitigation more generally and to build resilient communities. Access to such data therefore has some elements of a public good as well as being able to provide private benefits. That is relevant for any consideration of what data should be made available and who should pay for it. And that's one of the themes of our issues paper as well. And we're interested in views about that question. On the subject of affordability, to deliver the benefits to individuals and to the community that insurance cover for flood can provide after an event, insurers need to make it available and households need to take up the offer. How far should the question of affordability be taken? Some would argue that building or owning a property in a flood-prone area is at the risk of the property owner, who has the obligation to understand and deal with the full cost of that risk with the assistance of insurance if the owner so chooses. Others point to historical situations, such as councils opening up flood-prone land for development without owners being made aware of the risk, lower-income property owners who have lived for years or even decades in flood-prone areas without the means to pay new higher premiums for flood cover. The risk can change due to increasing urbanisation, or insurers might put a very high price on some flood risks without a competitive need or interest in limiting the price. So all of these things, I think, are relevant to the affordability question. So in the issues paper, we put forward the idea that the affordability problem needs for its solution some form of price discount system, and that leads to the idea of a flood insurance pool for properties with high flood risk. There are many significant questions yet to be answered about that idea. I look forward to submissions from some of you here today on how a high flood risk threshold can be determined and how a pool may work. But there are also a number of other fundamental policy issues. Should there be discounts for those facing high premiums? How do you do so while addressing the issues of moral hazard, equity, and risk mitigation? For example, what level of discount for which homes? Is there a case for a means test, or a risk mitigation test, or a residency test? Can a distinction be made between those living in flood-prone areas but for whom information was not available to inform their decision-making and those who moved there with full information? Can price signals be relied upon to provide adequate incentives to households to reduce their risk of flood? Or should access to a discount require some specific actions on the part of the household? The next slide, if I can find the right one. Yeah, this slide gives a further indication of the technical and practical matters that need to be worked through in designing an effective system of this kind. Actually, I haven't got the right slide here. Let me go back one. Here we go. I'll go back even one more. There we go. These are some of the issues that we need to deal with for designing a flood insurance pool. I won't elaborate on all these questions now, beyond saying that all input on how we might design a workable system of this kind is welcome. But let us take a brief look at the first and the third questions. The first one is about identifying the higher flood risk properties. This chart is in the issues paper, and it leads to a tough question. How do we determine a high flood risk threshold? The concept is very simple, but its implementation is far from simple. We've put two ideas on the table here, an engineering technique and what we've called an insurance market mechanism. Interestingly, all the actuaries say method B can't be made to work. They don't think so. They think an engineering solution is a good way around it. The engineers I've talked to say that's really hard. There should be an insurance market solution. So it's pretty obvious that there's a lot of thinking to do if we're going to have any kind of a high flood risk pool. And it's clearly very important that if we have one, that it works properly. So we await with interest submissions, not on why either technique may not work, we know enough about that. What we want to know is what are the design ideas that could enable each one to work and therefore give us a sensible way through to some kind of proposal on this. The third question in the previous slide was about funding the discounts. This slide illustrates, schematically of course, the magnitude of the discounts. It is the blue section on the right-hand side of the chart there. So who pays? If there is to be a system of premium discounts for high-risk properties, there are significant policy issues concerning who should meet the cost of the discounts. For example, is it reasonable to ask those who live in an area free of flood risk to assist those who live in flood-prone areas? Does the community have a responsibility to assist those who are ill-advised by local councils about the extent of flood risk or perhaps had no access to information? Can the incentives be aligned so that those with responsibility for funding the discounts face an incentive to reduce the funding requirement over time through taking mitigation action? There are costs in managing and mitigating flood risk, and there are additional costs when flooding occurs. The optimal insurance solution for flood cover could be regarded as one where the interests of all parties, that is, property owners, local councils and insurers, are aligned. And perhaps state governments are part of that too. Aligning these interests might mean, for example, insurers bearing some cost if a flood occurs. It could mean property owners bearing some cost to carry out risk mitigation steps, for example, building design and land preparation, in addition to paying insurance premiums. And it could involve councils taking relevant risk mitigation steps, for example, land zoning and use restrictions, building codes and standards, watercourse management. And, of course, there's data on flood risk to be collected and analysed to assist all parties. Under current mitigation arrangements and current market conditions, those insurers offering the cover do bear cost of flood risk. By the way, here's this sort of is a general schema around this idea. Under current arrangements and current insurance market conditions, the insurers that offer flood cover do bear costs if a flood occurs. There is not, however, any related obligation on property owners or councils to undertake flood risk mitigation at the present time. The parties are essentially operating separately, whereby insurers make their own risk assessments in order to set prices, and they may take account of the actions of individual property owners or councils, but there is no direct connection at the present time and no partnership between the parties aimed at both reducing flood risk and having insurers respond to the reductions. There are, of course, flood risk mitigation efforts made by some property owners and some councils, but they are not generally linked with insurer efforts to price and underwrite flood risk, and there is certainly no established cycle of the parties working together and responding to the efforts of each other. So one of the very potential positive outcomes of the work of the review panel is to assist in the generation of some kind of partnership arrangement that does put councils and property owners and insurers all working towards the same end. Well, let me turn now to some of the other topics in our issues paper. I won't talk about all of these, but I'll just quickly run you through what they are. Firstly, flood cover for other classes of assets. I've concentrated so far on home insurance, and that's the big issue, if you like, but it's not the only one. The question of contents insurance is important. What about home units, strata title properties? They're already, I think, more than 20% of the dwellings in Australia, and that number is growing and will continue to grow. And what about small business? I'll make a couple of comments about small business. The ability of communities to recover following a natural disaster can depend significantly on the local businesses being able to recover so that the local economy can remain viable. The ability of businesses to resume operation after a disaster depends whether jobs are available and whether the goods and services that the community needs to rebuild are available. And as for households, the ability of businesses to recover is affected significantly by their ability to call on insurance. During the course of the review, we've heard that many small businesses are underinsured, in particular for business interruption insurance. The reason often given is that small business will buy insurance to a price rather than on an assessment of their risks. The review panel would be very keen to hear ideas about how to encourage small business to take up insurance cover that properly meets their needs, with business interruption being the primary concern. And if you're wondering what that's about, it's not just having business interruption cover, it's having the right scope of cover, and it's having the right length of time. It's pretty clear if you look at what's gone on after the Victorian bushfires that a lot of organisations, if they'd had 2 years or 2 or 3 years of business interruption cover, may have been able to recover. But if they've only got 3 months or 6 months, then that just isn't enough. So there's some quite important issues, and unless small business gets going in a devastated area, then it's quite possible people don't even want to live there anymore. So there are a lot of issues around business insurance, even though the problem of flood cover itself is not necessarily the key issue. It's the overall levels of cover. Underinsurance. Bushfires reveal material underinsurance for total losses. And that leads to the... Well, there's underinsurance and there's non-insurance. Underinsurance leads to the question of some insured or replacement cover. The take-up of household insurance is high, and there would not appear to be a strong case to move to compulsory household insurance, given the administrative burden that would place on insurers and homeowners and the government. But the available evidence does suggest a significant proportion of homes are underinsured. For many risks, underinsurance is immaterial because the payout will be less than the sum insured. But natural disasters is where we see the greatest numbers of total losses. In these cases, underinsurance can result in the household facing financial hardship, but the precise extent and degree of underinsurance remain unclear. Although it's difficult to confirm this view, there was significant underinsurance evident in both the Canberra bushfires and the Victorian bushfires of 2009. Homes destroyed in the Canberra bushfires were found to be underinsured on average by 40% of their replacement cost. That's huge, isn't it? And in Victoria, there were total losses where the average claims were $132,000, but the average cost of rebuilding a home in Victoria was $230,000. So there is a significant issue around sum insured versus replacement cover. Some homeowners may choose an inadequate sum insured deliberately, but most simply underestimate the total cost of rebuilding their home to its original standard. And that's understandable given the nature of the task where often building expertise might even be necessary to make the estimate properly. Insurers have made commendable efforts to assist in the process, such as making home valuation calculators available to customers and indexing the sums insured to ensure their real value is maintained. But despite these efforts, underinsurance does persist. So the issues paper discusses two techniques aimed at addressing underinsurance. One is moving to replacement cover, and the other one is some insured policies with a top-up. The review panel understands that disputes between households and their insurers could occur over what replacement actually constitutes. Additionally, disputes are possible where cash settlements are sought rather than rebuilding. But we're interested in views on this topic, on how homeowners can be better protected in the event of total loss of their property. I've already made a reference to compulsory insurance. It's clearly highly debatable in respect of home insurance. And as for contents, the need for a lot of people who haven't got insurance having it is also debatable. But there are a lot of different circumstances, aren't there? If you're a 25-year-old who owns a computer and a TV and a few clothes, then it's not that important to have insurance. But if you're a 30-year-old single mother with running a household with two kids and you've got to educate them and so forth, then it can be very, very serious if you haven't got insurance. So there's a, and then you can go through most owner occupiers. The proportion of owner occupiers who have contents insurance is much, much higher than it is for renters. And so there's some interesting questions about contents. Let me move on to some other topics. The role of lending institutions. Lending institutions clearly could improve insurance coverage, and this has been raised a few times during our review. People who have taken out a mortgage know that their lender required them to have insurance. But when prompted, they also realise that the lenders don't check to see if they have maintained insurance coverage or to see what events they are covered for or what is the sum insured. And it's a fact that I think many lenders, as well as many other people, were blindsided by the recent floods. And it was only then that some credit unions and banks realised that a lot of their customers didn't have flood insurance. They just assumed, I think, in some cases that they did. So there's a rethinking going on around that in the banking industry. And a question that we're asking is, well, what level of responsibility do lenders have, both to themselves and to their customers, to ensure appropriate insurance cover? We've already talked a bit about measuring flood risk, and we asked the question, is a nationally consistent approach needed? And if so, who should undertake and fund the work? And indeed, how should it be done? Mitigating flood risk, I've talked a bit about that too, and it would be interesting to understand more about how past flood mitigation projects have actually affected the underwriting and pricing practices of insurers and reinsurers. other topics that are covered in our paper are consumer understanding, what measures could improve consumers' understanding of risk and insurance cover, and what about advice? We've got more and more people, of course, buying over the internet or over the telephone. Are there any issues around that? Claims disputes, claims dispute resolution, how could it be improved and made more transparent? Well, one big area, of course, is the flood versus storm issue. Beyond that, it's not clear to me that there is a major issue. In fact, I think the insurers have been very responsive in recent years to around claims disputes. So with the sole exception of the flood versus storm question, but I'm not the one here. I'm asking you, the public, if you like, what do you think? Is there a need for any further initiatives around disputes? Finally, other natural disasters. Is there a case for extending the scope of insurance to cover landslide and actions of the sea? And when we talk about a flood insurance pool, maybe landslide and actions of the sea could be put in there. And what about cyclones? We are hearing that in the aftermath of Cyclone Yasi, while policies automatically offer cyclone cover, I'm sure there are people up there who love to opt out because some insurers have withdrawn and the ones who are left in some cases are charging extraordinarily high prices compared with the past. So we may have an emerging market competition problem as well on cyclones. Well, look, that covers the issues I wanted to raise today. The importance of the role of insurance in the insurance industry in disaster recovery is not only understood and appreciated, it is critical to the actions of the economy. And if anyone's in any doubt about the importance to the economy, you only have to go back to when HIH failed and insurance disappeared in liability for many parts of the community, the economy slows down. So I think everybody recognises that insurance is a really important part of our economy. But there is a specific issue in regard to riverine flood and the absence of flood cover for many homeowners. And for good reason, the industry on its own cannot find a solution to the full range of availability and affordability aspects of flood insurance. Does a solution need to be found? Is it acceptable to continue without reform when the costs have to be paid by the community, charities and government? The two models that the Issues paper has put out for discussion, in conjunction with the flood insurance pool for high-risk homes and perhaps also for home units, are intended to supplement existing insurance arrangements and thereby address directly the issue of availability and affordability of cover. Is it necessary, is it appropriate to adopt one of those two models, or is it okay to stay with where we are and rely on the insurance industry to take the initiatives? We look forward to your contributions to the Issues paper, and I look forward to any questions now and to the rest of the presentations this morning. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Rick Shaw. I'm with the Institute of Actuaries. I'm the facilitator for today. Thanks, John. We're now going to hear three responses to John's paper and then break for morning tea. After the break, we're going to have a panel discussion. The panel will be the three review members, John and his two colleagues, and our three speakers. An important part of the discussion is the feedback, the questions and discussion from the floor, from the audience. We have, we'll go through the logistics about how to get questions, how to put in a question in a minute. We have a couple of minutes for a couple of questions from the floor now for John. And just while we're setting up a mic, I just might ask a couple of things, John. I've some experience with developing public policy, and I think it's like the way hospitals work a lot better if there's no patients. I think it's a lot easier to develop public policy without ever leaving Canberra, and it's quite clear that you're making you and the panel are making big effort to consult. And I think we all value that, you know. And a point you've made to the Institute of Actuaries is that you see yourself as discussing the options rather than defending the options that are presented in the paper. And I think that's important. But one of the things I wonder, could you just clarify the process from here? What happens? Submissions are due on the 14th, and what happens from there? What's the process?
Well, Rick, we are scheduled to report by the 30th of September, and we actually don't have any leeway around that because whatever comes out of our work, the government wants to know what the panel thinks before the next potential flood and bushfire season. And also, in terms of COAG and the National Disaster Resilience Initiatives, our report is going to go to the heads of treasuries of all the state governments, and our work is intended to form part of the National Disaster Resilience Strategy. So we don't have much leeway. So 30th of September, we'll be putting forward a final paper with recommendations. I don't think we've got time to do another discussion paper after we get submissions, but I can say to you that we may need to go to some parties for additional discussions. We haven't seen the submissions. When we do see the submissions, when they're all in, we may wish to test some of the ideas with some of the people, whether it be with insurers or consumer groups or state governments, etc. And so we can only make those decisions after we see all the submissions as we plan things out. But there isn't a huge amount of time. We've only got 2.5 months from the closing of submissions. I can say to you that we will engage with anybody, any parties that we think can help us to come to practical solutions. And we're very hopeful that by the time we finish this and make recommendations, that we've got a set of recommendations that the government is prepared to implement and that will be beneficial in all the terms that I've been talking about.
And just on that, I just think it might be useful to clarify some aspects around your terms of reference. This is primarily a review of the insurance arrangements around natural disasters. But you've made the point in a number of meetings that it includes you will be covering the need for mitigation on that. It's not.
Well, I think both the government, including the Minister Shorten, who set up the review, and the panel understand all the things that, for example, insurers and actuaries worry about here. That is, incentives mustn't be wrong, risk mitigation must be promoted, there mustn't be more building in flood-prone areas. Nobody likes the fact that we have this flood insurance problem that we've got. But this is a once-in-a-generation opportunity as well to make some serious impact on it. It's 35 years since the government last authorised some kind of a review. I was actually involved in that as a young actuary. 35 years ago, 1976, nothing happened. So it would be a crying shame if we get through another major review. A lot of resources have been put into this by many people. It'd be a crying shame if we can't get some positive outcomes this time.
Well, we won't hold you responsible when you're a younger actuary than you are now for no outcomes. But it's interesting, you're talking about 30, you've got 2.5 months to solve an issue that's a once-in-a-generation issue. I mean, that's a challenge.
Well, it's really more than 2.5 months from the outset. We started early March. A lot of work's already been done, as you can see, both by us and by many other people. We've had some marvellous input from a lot of different people, and we've got many important things to follow up on, and I'm fully expecting that the material we get in submissions will require further follow-up. And by the way, when it comes to designing a high flood risk pool, if that's what we're going to go with, then we're going to need to call on all the external ideas and expertise that we can as well. So, this is a live process. I think we're going to have to just make the practical or sort of pragmatic decisions about how far we can go at the time we make our recommendations. We can't solve everything, and we don't know what the responses of the decision-making parties are going to be after. But I think we've come a long, long way, and we'll get a lot further in the next 2.5 months.
I think at one point you made in your presentation was that we need a partnership approach to this, because I mean we as the actuaries are we sort of got some strengths on the funding side, but we've been learning a lot about the mitigation issues, and we see the need, say around flood mapping, for there to be a collection of interests to rise above our personal interests for what is the sake of good policy outcome. So I think that partnership approach is key. And that applies also to the government. I mean, we have state, federal, local relationships it's a complex part of your work, I think.
Well, it is. The best understanding I've got at the moment is that Queensland councils are working harder than ever to try and do something about this. Like the insurers, they've been stung to some extent by the events that have occurred. They're uncomfortable with what's happened and they want to do more, but they've got other pressures. I'm told that in New South Wales, we've got, for example, the Hawkesbury Nepean area is an area that's flood prone. We've got some part of the New South Wales government being very conscious of that and wanting to make sure that everything, all the risk mitigation is being handled. Excuse me. At the same time, there's pressure for opening up more land for housing, and there's a different part of the New South Wales government, I understand, that's putting some pressure on councils to open up that land. Now, councils have to resist that land, but, you know, we often hear that it's councils who are the villains in the piece here, but sometimes it's a state government. So there's, you know, and there are clearly there's politics behind these sorts of things as well. So there aren't easy routes to this, Rick, but one of the things we can contribute. Of course, he's unravelling all of that so that at least to the extent that we can't solve it, at least we can make clear what the issues are.
I think I'd like to just close with one question that's come through on the SMS. If we could go up to... Yeah, thanks. Just to clarify, John, is the panel looking at options other than a pool to subsidise flood insurance? And, for example, the rebate system that exists in health is been suggested as an option.
What, some kind of a tax rebate or some... Well, look, the... If there are discounts given, they've got to be paid for somewhere. If you have a full funding model, which is the normal insurance model, then the discounts given need to be made up by some immediate funding from somewhere. That could be come in many forms, but it's also possible that you actually underfund it, which governments can do, but insurers and private people can't. And you fund it later, so you don't actually put any money aside until you have a disaster, and then perhaps the government pays. So there are different funding models here. I'm not sure that tax rebates would be the answer here. After all, many of the people we're trying to deal with don't have high tax anyway, and the government keeps trying to lift reduce the tax at the lower income levels. So you're talking here about the funding of it, not yes. Not the actual granting of discounts. And when it comes to the granting of discounts, it seems to us that being explicit about those discounts is very important. If you give people discounted premiums without anybody knowing what the full risk premium is, then you've already compromised part of the risk mitigation, risk management requirements here. We think that it's very important that if any discounts or any breaks, price breaks, or subsidies are given, that the knowledge of the full price is always out there in front of the consumer and the councils and anybody else who's involved.
Okay, thanks, John. We've the bell's tolling for us. we've got to now. You'll have on the panel this after the break. That's where you'll get to throw the curly questions at John and the other panel members.